Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm one of the hosts on the channel. I'm very excited today to be speaking to a book that's in fact just won an award. At BISA 2022, the book has won an outstanding first book prize, which makes it even more exciting to welcome the author, Dr. Sophie Haspila, to our podcast to talk about her book titled Prescribing Peace: How Listing Armed Groups as Terrorists Hurts Negotiations. Published by Manchester University Press in 2021, the book offers a systemic examination of the impact of proscription on peace negotiations, which is a really fascinating topic that has both serious theoretical implications as well as incredibly practical things that people should know when engaging with peace negotiations. So I'm really excited to have the opportunity to welcome you, Sophie, to the podcast.
Thanks, Miranda. I'm really glad to be speaking with you today.
Maybe you could start us off, please, by introducing yourself, your background, and sort of explain why you decided to write this book.
Sure. So I'm Flemish-Belgian, grew up in France, ended up in the UK for my sins, for my studies. And then I worked in the field of conflict resolution and dialogue processes for quite a while, working for the UN, for NGOs, for a range of actors. And this leads me to why I started writing this book. It was after 9/11, when I had just finished my master's degree. It was during my master's degree that 9/11 happened and that the whole war of terrorism took hold. And I was working in Colombia back in 2004 for International Crisis Group at the time, and all the talk was of terror and terrorism. And the previous peace negotiation with the FARC had failed. President Alvaro Uribe Vélez was in power. And, you know, in one particular speech, he used the word terror 59 times. And I was really struck at the time that, any kind of move away from that seemed completely impossible. And so sort of fast forward 12 years later, I had decided to embark on a PhD, and it mainly came because I was working for an NGO called Conciliation Resources. I was their head of policy, and we were starting to be very affected, actually, by the terrorist listing and framing itself and some of the legislation. We had a lot of questions on whether we could engage with such a group because it was listed. What were the kind of legal implications for the staff being, you know, in contact or not? Did we, you know, infringe on some of the material support to terrorism regulations? And I realized that there was very little out there in terms of academic work on the impact of prescription. So initially I came to the question and the idea really from a perspective of like, how is this impacting sort of third party mediators, you know, the peace builders, the people who were, you know, like me, sort of trying to engage with listed armed groups. And then I realized it was quite a slightly egocentric way of looking at the question, because obviously these listings, you know, were having massive effects and implications on the whole sort of nature of conflict and peace in Colombia. And so the book really comes out of my PhD. And when I started the PhD in 2012, Juan Manuel Santos, who was then the president in Colombia, had started a peace negotiation with the FARC. So going back to that image of when I was living in Colombia in 2004 and, you know, an idea of a peace negotiation was completely impossible, to that moment in 2012 where, you know, a negotiation was actually happening in public and on the cards, I got really interested in trying to unpack, well, how did we get from here to there, right? Right, all governments say that they don't, you know, negotiate with terrorists, but clearly, you know, we do. But how does the effect of calling them, of listing them, of labeling them as terrorists have on the possibilities of engaging them in peace processes?
It makes a lot of sense kind of hearing that background to see how that resulted in the book, right? That focus I already mentioned at the beginning between sort of theory and literature, but also like really practical implications, which I think is what makes the book's contributions really clear and really helpful, is that you managed to do both of those things. And it makes a lot of sense hearing about your background, that you're able to do that. So I'd love to kind of go through the main points of what you're arguing and especially how that applies to the example of Colombia. But to kind of give us a foundation to be able to do that, could you tell us a little bit about kind of where prescription as a sort of policy tool comes from and how it's changed over time?
Sure. So prescription is the act of listing an armed group as a terrorist organization, right? And it did exist before 9/11. So actually, the UK was, you know, one of the first countries in 1974 to develop a prescription regime, and it was mainly targeted towards the IRA. But then it broadened out in the 1980s to include other groups at the international level as well. In the US, you had a prescription regime from the 1990s onwards. So you had some countries across the world who were using prescription as a tool, you know, to target particular groups, to list these groups as terrorist organizations. What you didn't have was this sort of multilateral embedding of prescription regime, which very much happened post 9/11. So, you know, as we all know, after 9/11 happened, the whole world rallied around, you know, the US in this particular instance. And there was a huge sort of political willingness to give support, right? And to kind of come up with policy tools to show international solidarity, I guess. And so what happened at the UN level was that in September 2001, straight after the 9/11 attacks, the UN Security Council used Chapter 7. So for those of you who know more about the UN, so Chapter 7 is the right to call for self-defense, right? So by the US, you know, asking for the support of other members of the Security Council. Now, Chapter 7, until that point in history, had never been used against a non-state actor. It had always been used against violence from states. And I think many people don't realize that. So the paradigm shifted completely. Chapter 7 was used against the idea of non-state actors committing terrorism. And so prescription regimes were embedded at that multilateral level. And there's some excellent books that, you know, unpack a lot of that that have also come out more recently by Gavin Sullivan on the law of the list, or Alice Martini as well on UN counterterrorism, that are, you know, going into that in much more detail. But basically what happened was that prescription became something that was mandatory for all member states of the UN. So across the world, whether they're regional organizations, say like the EU or governments, were encouraged to develop their own prescription regime. So it means like in a country here, I'm based now in Egypt, you have, you know, a national prescription regime, and the Egyptian government can decide, you know, who they want on this list. And this was done at the UN level without explicitly defining what terrorism is, right, or who should be considered a terrorist. So it was a kind of a decentralization of the power of, you know, creating these lists to member states across the world. So really, the implication was that, you know, going back to your question, you know, how has prescription sort of evolved over time? It didn't really exist in its form, you know, in its multilateral form before 9/11. And now, you know, 20 years on from 9/11, we have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of lists worldwide from, you know, the kind of UN multilateral framing that gives it international legitimacy. And then, of course, you know, a multiplicity of lists at the national and regional level, really, across the world.
I'm really glad you emphasized kind of the unique use of, or that first moment of the use of Chapter 7, because that is really important, I think, in the rest of your analysis coming through to explain kind of the impact that this change then had. And what I really appreciated in terms of like the usefulness of it is how you then go on to talk about the impact of prescription. So it's not just, okay, all these countries are now doing it, but what does that mean? What effect does that have? And you divide it up into material impact and symbolic impact. Could you maybe help us understand kind of what these different impacts are, for example, in Colombia?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it's helpful, you know, to look at a case to understand it more concretely. So, the uses of words have always played a role in conflicts, right? We've always sort of labeled our opponent one way or the other, and that hasn't changed. But what sort of international prescription has done is that it has meant that the whole sort of international community sort of stands behind the use of the terrorist label, right? Or if you're a group, you ended up on a list, you know, you are inherently illegitimate, right? And so the implication of this is that, of course, there are sort of clear symbolic elements around delegitimization, you know, shunning, stigmatization. And here I build on the work, you know, of a lot of the securitization literature, also the literature coming out of, you know, more labeling and that sort of thing. But you also have kind of quite concrete implications because it is, at the end of the day, a law. Right? So it has also very clear material effects. But kind of what I realized in the case of Colombia is that these aren't sort of separated or segregated, is that the symbolic and the material really interact and reinforce each other. So I'll give you a really concrete example from Colombia. You know, the FARC had already been obviously, you know, they were a non-state armed group, insurgent group. They'd been vilified, you know, as any group is in a context of a civil war in Colombia. But post 9/11 and with the reframing of the conflict as a war of terrorists, what happened was that the government, the Colombian government, was deeply bolstered in its fight against the FARC. And so this had very concrete material implications. So just to give you a specific example, the US Congress in 2002 voted for all the aid that was going towards the fight against drugs, I guess, and anti-narcotics in Colombia, to be able to be used in the war against counterterrorism, right? So what happened was that the Colombian government received, you know, a huge amount of material support, you know, in sort of concrete military equipment, hardware, but also intelligence, you know, quite a wide array. But on the other hand as well, more symbolically, of course, the FARC were sort of put in this idea that, you know, they were very much beyond the pale, deeply stigmatized. Their whole, you know, political project was considered, of course, illegitimate. But also it had real stigmatizing effects for anyone who might be associated with them, right? And you see that in a range of armed conflicts across the world. I'm thinking, for instance, as well of the LTT in Sri Lanka. So how the whole, like, Tamil project, you know, political project was deeply delegitimized as well, or say in the Basque Country, I've recently returned from there, where you had the listing not just of the armed group, but all of the political, cultural, you know, media, youth, etc., all the other affiliations as well. So one of the things I explore in the book is how both the symbolic and material elements impacted, but not just the armed group, but also the government and also potentially third-party actors. So I kind of analyze it in terms of how they played off, you know, in terms of the reality of these actors, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. And thank you sort of for illustrating it with examples, because I think that really helps make the link quite clear. And Colombia in a lot of ways seems like a really good case for you, because there are such clear ways in which this policy change has an impact. But you look at kind of other aspects, right? It's not just that prescription creates these material and symbolic effects. It also has sort of an impact on not just how outsiders deal with the non-state actor, but also within the conflict itself, kind of the actors that are directly competing. And you talk about the perception of symmetry or asymmetry, which is really important in a conflict. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about kind of why that perception is so important, and particularly how is this impacted when prescription gets involved?
Sure. So, you know, one of the things I focus in the book isn't just the impact prescription has on the nature of the conflict, which, you know, I trace as being pretty major, but also more how it influences the efforts at getting to, you know, a potential political settlement and negotiation. So I really explore what you could describe as the pre-negotiation phase, you know, of a conflict. And here, symmetry and asymmetry is key. So, it's all about power, right? So something like prescription, as I described earlier, obviously deeply bolsters, you know, the government versus the armed group. But what it also does is that it affects the possibility of creating, I guess, what you could describe as a sense of symmetry, which is often essential to get a negotiation off the ground. So once, you know, opponents, armed actors, conflict parties get to the decision of maybe negotiating a way out of an armed conflict, it's really important, and I mean, a lot of the negotiation literature shows this, that you have to create a sort of a sense of symmetry. So you're never going to get an actual symmetry, an actual fact, right? But you can create a process that gives a form of recognition, a certain status, you know. You can sort of create this symmetry through the process that will allow, you know, both parties at the end of the day will have a veto on the outcome, right? They can each pull out of the negotiation. So that inherently gives them, you know, a certain equality, if you like, you know, over the process and the power. And so one of the things that I explore is how prescription affects this, and how what has happened, and it's very relevant for Colombia, but I think in a lot of other contexts in the world, is that the burden of proof, or if you like, or like the is has been shifted completely onto the shoulders of the non-state actors. And so there's a real, what's the word I'm looking for, sort of dislike or refusal to give any sense of status, you know, or recognition, you know, to that other actor. So, for instance, in the case of Colombia, it's the FARC who had to take a whole number of unilateral steps to build confidence in the lead up to the peace negotiations. So unilateral ceasefires, the government always refused to have a bilateral ceasefire, for instance, you know, unilateral release of hostages, you know, so you see a lot of more sort of unilateralism, as it were, you know, in the lead up to these processes.
I think that's a really interesting aspect of it. And in a lot of ways, that makes the like barrier to entry, I suppose, of negotiations like that much harder, because you're asking one side to do a bunch of stuff that the other side isn't asked to do or asked to have them go first.
Exactly. And I think, all right. I think one of the things that came out for me really strongly, you know, writing this book and you know, thinking about the sort of broader picture, is that the whole sort of terrorist framing, in effect, while it might sort of encourage, you know, this perception that militarily, you know, the war is being won, as it were, you know, against terrorism, in effect, what it does is that it goes against one of the central ideas in, I guess, conflict resolution theory, which is rightness. And I think we can get into that, but basically the idea is that you know, two parties need to be feeling, you know, the pain of the conflict, right? To want to sort of exit it. But by you know, listing the other party as terrorist, and you're creating them as a sort of an entity that's non-negotiable, that's irrational, you're making it impossible for that entity to envisage, obviously, a political way out, but you're also making it impossible for your own citizens or your public to ever imagine, you know, being able to negotiate with such a group, right? So you're really raising the entry cost, increasing the barriers to negotiation.
Which doesn't really necessarily help get to negotiation. But I would love to kind of poke at that a little bit, because ripeness theory is such a big part of kind of the study of civil wars and negotiation. So how, kind of taking your book into account, taking your argument into account, how does that change what we should understand about ripeness theory going forward?
So I think, you know, the evidence that came out of the Colombia case really sort of shows that what prescription does is almost shift the parameters, or, you know, it does what you wouldn't expect it to do, right? So, you know, you would assume that by listing an armed group as terrorist, and you're, you know, supporting the government so much that they're going to win this war, you know, against the armed group, and that somehow it's going to, you know, lead towards peace, if you're going to have a sort of quite basic understanding of it. And often that's how, for instance, even the war in Colombia has been framed, the peace process there, that, you know, the FARC were battered and bruised to the negotiation table, right? That's kind of quite a common understanding. Oh, they only got there because, you know, the government gave it to them so tough, basically. And that was also thanks to the terrorist framing. But in actual fact, what my book shows is that, yes, of course, you know, they were really beaten and bruised, and nobody denies that, right? It was, you know, brutal, and the armed group was very much affected. So was, you know, the government as well, to a large extent. But what also happened was that it's much more complex than that, and it led to lots of other costs. So in ripeness theory, we have this idea of the mutually hurting stalemate on the one hand, and then the way out on the other. So when it comes to the mutually hurting stalemate, it's this idea that, you know, both parties are going to feel a hurt, right, towards in the conflict, and so are going to want to exit from that hurt, because they can no longer, you know, escalate beyond that. And so I guess what I unpack is that this hurt is not necessarily just military, it can also be political. And so, for instance, in the case of Colombia, there were a lot of elements in that strategy that was underpinned by the terrorist framing that really came back to hurt them. So, for instance, a lot of the human rights violations, they came with this very sort of intense military strategy, like extrajudicial executions, for instance, ended up leading, for instance, to the U.S. trade agreement being put on hold, and that was felt very much by the Colombian government, realizing, you know, the limits, if you like, of their military strategy as well. So the pain, if you like, isn't necessarily just military, it can also be political. But I think the biggest lesson of the book when it comes to ripeness theory is about the way out. It's that, you know, the mutually hurting stalemate, at the end of the day, if you have nowhere to go, is not going to lead to ripeness. And, you know, Zartman in his initial theory, of course, also highlighted this, but it's often been lost along the way. And I guess in my analysis, I try and reinstate the importance of the way out. The way out being, you know, where does this conflict go if it's not armed? You know, what is the political space? And I guess the issue with prescription is that it makes the possibility of a negotiated solution impossible. And so you have to have this kind of intermediary step, which I've described as a link with stick ceasefire, and we can get into that. But what happens is that it kind of makes it much more protracted, much longer, much more complicated. And also it really shifts the nature of the type of peace process that you can have. And that's kind of where in the book I really unpack the differences between the peace negotiation that led to the Kaiwan negotiation, the pre-negotiation process, and the most recent ones towards Havana. I don't know if we can that's a little bit too detailed, but there's some really fundamental differences between those two processes.
Could you maybe highlight for us one or two of those biggest differences, perhaps?
So, of course, I mean, you know, they were, I'm not saying that all the differences are due to prescription, right? But what you do see is that in the first instance, so pre-9/11, you had a pre-negotiation process that was at the highest level of government between the two leaders, shaking hands, you know, backslapping. You had a very immediate devilification. You know, they were given a status. So the asymmetry element we were just discussing, you know, was very immediate. It was all happening in Colombia. Civil society would have access to all the different actors, even international actors, third parties, etc. It was kind of quite fluid. And the devilification process happened very immediately. In the case of Havana, the pre-negotiation process itself took 2 years. And the first public handshake between the president of Colombia and the leader of the FARC at the time, Timoshenko, Rodrigo Londoño, happened 2 years in the formal negotiation. So it kind of describes to what extent sort of how difficult it was to establish a public negotiation that made the government and the FARC seem as they were, you know, negotiating in equal parts, if you like, as equal parts.
Thank you for kind of explaining that. I think that comparison really kind of shows the impact. And I want to sort of ask you to elaborate on another bit of your answer, kind of how you talk about, well, it makes it a longer process to get to negotiations. And you kind of have a solution for this in your book, or you talk about sort of how we can think about that longer process. You call it the political landing strip. Can you tell us about kind of what that is and how they can be created?
Yeah, so the political landing strip has to come alongside one of these other elements I described, which is the linguistic ceasefire that I should probably also unpack a little. But the political landing strip is this idea that for the listed group to be able to see or envisage, you know, an exit out of the armed strategy, they have to have a political way out. They have to have somewhere for them to go. And, you know, if they're illegalized, listed, pushed underground, well, then that's kind of near impossible. And of course, that goes hand in hand with this terrorist framing and rhetoric, because obviously the idea is, well, if they're terrorists, they're obviously non-political. They don't have, you know, they shouldn't have anywhere to go. But in actual fact, many of these groups that are listed as terrorist organizations, you know, do have a political reality, grievance. They do have, you know, communities as well that they represent. So in the case of the FARC, the political landing strip had a lot to do with, you know, grassroots movements, political movements. There was also a very interesting exchange that was done, which was very unusual, and because of the nature of the listing. So they had an epistolary, so a letter exchange, if you like, with a group of about 40 or more, actually, intellectuals and civil society actors and academics, Colombianos and Colombianas for La Paz. And in these, sorry, I was mixing up. So I think there were about 30 letters that were exchanged with this group. And over the course of 3 years, they released unilaterally 40 hostages that they were keeping. So you had these sort of spaces where, you know, the FARC would try and engage in this, you know, sort of humanitarian and political dialogue with members of civil society and academics. But because they couldn't do that physically, they were doing that, for instance, through these public letter exchanges. Or you see, you know, other engagement at a much more localized level. Through pastoral dialogues, which were dialogues that were sort of given cover by the church, if you like. So it's very interesting to see in spaces where contact and you know, is impossible, and listing makes this contact very impossible, it still happens because often of innovations, right, from civil society actors, often at the most kind of grassroots level, you know, throughout a conflict. But none of that would have happened, any of these kind of, you know, this possibility of having a political future, if you like, if it hadn't been for the linguistic ceasefire. So maybe I can jump into that, Miranda.
Please go for it.
Okay, thanks. So basically, the concept of vilification and the importance of de-vilification, again, in conflict resolution and in sort of peace processes is very established. So you need to have a certain element of de-vilification, otherwise you can't sort of create enough trust, at least you're not going to already have trust, but you have to have enough that you can just start and initiate a process, right, with your opponent, but also for your citizens to even accept the possibility that you might want to be doing that. And so in the context of prescription, our understanding of vilification and devilification was sort of not enough theoretically. And so that's kind of really when I went back to the empirics and in the case of Colombia. And what was fascinating for me was when I was interviewing people, and so the whole book is based on about 50 interviews, you know, with conflict parties and analysts, but also I did a sort of a discourse analysis over 20 years of the statements made by the FARC and the Colombian government. And so what started coming up in all these empirics was a complete shift in the rhetoric of President Juan Manuel Santos, exactly at the moment where conditions were starting to be created for like the pre-negotiation process, right? Even 2 years before the formal negotiation. And so that was fascinating to me. And I started really unpicking and unpacking that. And so it kind of ended up, you know, in the book as this idea of the linguistic ceasefire. And so what does that mean? In effect, the linguistic ceasefire has sort of three main components. So the first one and the first step was that you really notice that the president's re-acknowledged the existence of the conflict. So before that, it was all terrorism, talk of terrorists. You wouldn't see any mention of the FARC of under the 8 years of the Uribe presidency. They'd kind of been morphed into this, you know, idea of worldwide terrorism, but you would never see even their acronym or their name, you know, being used, right? They had kind of been erased from the reality of the Colombian conflict. And so what you see Juan Manuel Santos do is he re-acknowledges the fact that there is a conflict, there is a political conflict in Colombia, and it's not just a war against terrorists. The second thing he does is that he completely drops the terrorist label when it comes to describing the group. So you'll still see him use it to describe certain particular armed actions, you know, that he considers to be terrorist actions. But you'll no longer see the group itself being associated with a terrorist label. So there's a kind of, you know, disjuncture there. And so the third point is really that there's this separation, if you like, what I was just describing now, between the act and the actor. So the idea that, yes, you can use terrorism to describe the act, but not the actor anymore. And so I really think what it did was to create that space, that possibility that the FARC could become something else than terrorists, you know? Even if they did sometimes commit, or they had definitely in the past committed some terrorist actions, it didn't mean that they necessarily had to stay, you know, and remain terrorists, that you could not negotiate with them. And so basically this linguistic ceasefire, which was really obvious in the discourse analysis that I did, what was really interesting was also how it played out from the perspective of the FARC. Because in my interviews with them, what was so important, they kept on saying how, you know, well, you know, with Juan Manuel Santos, what was different was that, you know, he acknowledged the existence of the conflict. They would, you know, so they really, it played out in terms of the FARC that they felt that he was actually also someone that they could negotiate with, right? It's a very dialectical, you know, it's a relational dynamic, a peace process. And so it's also about the kind of, how would you describe it? Sort of signals that are passed as well between, you know, between the different actors.
Well, and it goes back to what you were saying earlier around perception, right? And how that's such a key part of it, even if it's in a lot of ways intangible, the idea of, you know, being able to hear a report and go, oh, actually, hang on, he doesn't sound like the other guys, or he doesn't sound like he used to. Maybe there's an opening here.
Exactly, to shift it, because in effect, they thought he was going to continue Uribe's policy because he was his minister of defense. So they had very, very low expectations when he came to power. And I think the shift in the rhetoric, the fact that he recognized the conflict, but also enshrined it, for instance, in the victims' law, and, you know, made a few very clear overtures towards them, I think gave them confidence that, hang on a minute, this might be quite different.
So that's clearly sort of something that can be taken to other contexts and other conflicts, right? An idea of, hang on, have you thought about a linguistic ceasefire? What could that look like in this context? Could that make some sort of overture for negotiations? If we think about kind of the other parts of the book and going back to the idea of the political landing strip, are there any other sort of key tools or possible tools that you would almost recommend following that idea of a linguistic ceasefire?
I mean, I think what's important with the linguistic ceasefire idea is more the broader understanding of how narratives and labels can shift the story of a conflict, right? But also towards resolution. So I think what's very applicable to concretely as well to other armed contexts, but also politically as well, and we've seen it in recent years, is also how much more sort of extreme framing, makes engagement between two sides much harder. And so obviously with a terrorist label, it's extreme in the sense that what I'm looking at is also the listing, right? So it's not just the use of the word, but it also is embedded in a whole legal framework with, you know, very direct implications as well. So, you know, the linguistic ceasefire was just sort of a moment, right, to get things off the ground. But then obviously much more has to come. And so in the case of the FARC, the group was delisted by the EU, by the US. And so there were fundamental shifts. But what hadn't happened, and now, you know, with the recent Colombian elections and Gustavo Petro winning recently, there might be hope that things get better. But since the signature of the peace accord, it's been hugely challenging for the FARC, actually, in this transition process. And I really think that the terrorist label has still really stuck to them. They haven't really been able to shake it off. I think one of the fundamental issues has been that the media hasn't stopped using the term at all. I think once you sort of, you know, let something loose like that at a political level, then it takes on a life of its own. And it was really interesting to me because in 2015, so 3 years into the formal negotiation, you had President Santos calling on the media to say, please stop calling them terrorists, you know, they're transitioning, we need to move on, we need to put the conflict behind us, etc. And the media, you know, still using this terminology. And so when the peace referendum was rejected in Colombia in 2016, I wasn't necessarily so surprised because so little work had been done. You know, at the much broader population level, people, you know, had this image of the FARC, of course, as merely terrorists. So why would we agree to, you know, a peace agreement with them? And one of the very unfortunate sides of this has been also the killing, you know, of FARC-led leaders, but also of Afro-Colombian indigenous leaders, other sort of grassroots activists who are often seen as associated with the FARC, since the peace agreement was signed. So I think the latest count in January 2021 was that about 253 leaders of the FARC had been assassinated. So this kind of continued stigmatization, continued polarization has been really, really raw, you know, and still vivid in Colombia. So I wouldn't want to sort of, you know, sell a false story here. That I think what I argue in the book is that the linguistic ceasefire was sort of essential to get the negotiation off the ground, right? But it wasn't quite enough, you know, to fundamentally reshape, as it were, the relationships and, you know, the kind of the post-conflict environment either.
Well, in some ways, the fact that there was such a difference between the sort of ability of political elites to negotiate an agreement at all, but the difference in kind of how it was discussed in public, in some ways that actually emphasizes the importance of the linguistic ceasefire, because you have it in one arena and see progress able to happen from there, and you don't see it in the other arena. And in fact, then it's just stopped. So I actually think it in some ways lends it more weight, which is really interesting. And I kind of wanted to ask a little bit about that, because you've just really helpfully explored the impact of not having a linguistic ceasefire in the public arena. But could you maybe tell us a little bit more about kind of how you think prescription, the lifting of prescription, the changing of the language around it? We've talked about it in terms of getting to negotiations, and we've talked about it in terms of what the public did or did not, kind of was or was not brought along with it. But what about in the actual negotiations itself?
I mean, I think it plays an important role, but more vis-a-vis the relationship between the public, you know, and the government, right? So in the case of Colombia, I think within the negotiation themselves, what I gathered from my interviews was that the tone was always very sort of respectful on all sides, you know. They definitely didn't, nobody use the terrorist sort of word or label, you know. So they got to that stage, and the interactions were, you know, obviously it was very difficult, and it was a long, drawn-out sort of negotiation. But it was done, you know, in a very sort of, how to say it, framed and constructive way, if you like. And I think also both sides sort of really humanized each other throughout the process, right, of spending so long sitting there in Cuba, you know, negotiating, being on these different working group levels, etc. I think when the impact of prescription, what the impact can have, you know, during a negotiation process, you can think of different cases where listing might have happened bang in the middle of a negotiation. And here I can think of the case of the LTT, for instance, in Sri Lanka. So the EU ended up listing the LTT right in the middle of a formal negotiation process between, you know, the LTT and the Sri Lankan government. And that had, you know, a really negative effect, you know, in the midst of these negotiations. And what was a little bit surreal was that something like the EU listing is a classic bureaucratic tool, right? So it had been agreed way before, but it being the EU, you know, it sort of came to be at a moment that politically was completely inopportune. You know, it was the wrong time and the wrong moment. And so that's the issue with prescription, is that it's a super blunt instrument tool. It also doesn't differentiate at all between different groups, and it really homogenizes, you know, who is on this these lists, right? So you have, say, I don't know, in the UK's list, you'll have, you know, a group like ETA alongside, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, or Al Qaeda, or, you know, the Real IRA, and the PKK, for instance, you know. So it also sort of, if you like, I would argue that the prescription itself, the lists themselves, and that's something that someone like Gavin Sullivan also describes, it, and Marijke de Goede, that the lists create a reality. So what prescription does in effect is that it kind of, you know, reinforces a lot of the makes group these groups into almost something else, and kind of makes association between these groups that, you know, didn't exist beforehand, right? So it's kind of a very, I mean, it's a fascinating space, I think, for scholarly research and study. I'm really excited because, you know, since I started the PhD and then, you know, transformed that into the book, and I've been working on it for a while now, but it's becoming really an increasingly, you know, energized and dynamic space of research. So there are, you know, more people working on the issue, and, you know, younger researchers like master's students will get in touch with me and others, you know, who want to work on the impact of prescription. Or so I think that's really exciting.
That's really cool. I'm glad to hear that. And I wanted to kind of, in addition to the academics that are interested in it, I was wondering actually to go back to your question you mentioned in the your own introduction, where you said, oh, well, that's a bit narcissistic. But I'm actually really curious and was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about kind of all of this. We've been talking a lot about the impact of prescription on the non-state actor, on the dynamics of the conflict. on relationships with other countries, on relationships with the public in the country. But how does prescription impact third-party people who get involved, like you were before your PhD?
Yeah, so I think the book basically concludes that, you know, it does. And in a way, it reinforces a lot what these organizations themselves, you know, had been saying through much more sort of practitioner analysis of, you know, specific case studies or that sort of thing. So what seems to be happening is that prescription is affecting where third-party actors are able and willing, you know, to act, who they can engage with or not, what kind of funding can be used or not. I think this is particularly concerning. I think there's an added dimension when it comes to the Middle East or to conflicts that have been framed as sort of Islamic armed conflict. There seems to be a sort of an increase aspect of the phenomenon. So that's also something that I'm exploring in some future research. But at the end of the day, what you're seeing is that a lot of third-party actors or mediators are not necessarily always concerned about the legal repercussion, but also the political repercussion, you know, how they're going to be perceived, say, you know, a charity in the UK that has UK charity status, right? Being seen to be, you know, working and engaging with a particular listed group. So what you see is also quite a lot of self-censorship. And then you see, you know, very concrete elements of, the US law comes with the risk of spending 15 years in jail for being in contact with the listed group, whether you're trying to convince them to lay down their weapons or not, you know? So that's kind of very specific, and it has an impact way beyond American citizens because it's extraterritorial. So at the end of the day, that was kind of my starting point. And I guess one of the conclusions is that, yes, it does have an impact on third-party actors. However, because a lot of mediation outfits and third-party actors are very sort of resilient and very resourceful, you also see a lot of these innovative mechanisms, like I described, you know, around letter exchanges, for instance, or using, you know, different ways of being in contact with the group. So what you're seeing is, like, you're seeing a lot of the diplomats, if you like, being pushed out of the game. So how, when a lot of governments might have played a leading role, negotiating with certain armed groups. Now what you see is much more sort of nimble, dynamic sort of lower key organizations and more discreet, often, you know, playing these roles. And so I think that's also really important to reflect on that, to reflect on, okay, so who has access to these groups? What information do we have on these groups? And also more broadly for researchers as well, right? The kind of the impact it's having on the possibility of doing this kind of research. So even for myself, when I was doing my PhD, obviously, you know, you go through these ethics committee, which, you know, is completely normal. We all have to do that. But the fact that in my case, the FARC weren't listed by the UK was really helpful. And it means that I wouldn't have been able to do this research, say, for instance, on ETA, who was listed at the time, and I'm doing some research on now, for instance, and their transition process, you know. So I think we really have to reflect on how the counterterrorism framing and prescription regime is also affecting our ability to do research and to understand these groups.
That's a really interesting point about research that I think is going to resonate with a lot of people. And interesting as well that it's kind of the diplomats that might be more bureaucratically constrained, for example, to take these innovative steps. So I'm glad I asked that, and I'm glad you mentioned it at the beginning, because that was, I think, quite a useful addition to what you've discussed about what you've talked about in your book. And obviously, to the listeners, you know, everything we've talked about so far is in more detail in the book, if you're interested. So this is very much kind of a high level tour of the book. But I wanted to ask a little bit now, as we come towards the end of the interview, about some of the process of writing the book, right? Because this comes from a lot of places. It comes from your practical experience. It comes from academic research. It comes from you said up to 50, about 50 interviews, and quite a long process. There was a lot of, you know, effort that went into this. And I was wondering if there are any things in particular that you remember being really surprised about when you came across them in that process. I know, for example, as a reader, there were some things that jumped out at me, like just how many times the word terrorist was or was not used in particular sets of speeches, for example. But was there anything in particular that comes to mind about surprise in the process?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I want to highlight is how this idea of the linguistic ceasefire came about, because I think it's good as you know, academics to also be sort of transparent about how this sausage is made, right? How do we go about doing this research? And I think I describe it as in the book as a mix of sort of inductive and inductive reasoning, but, you know, the back and forth between the theory and the empirics, you know, all the time. And so one of the things that really struck me is, and I knew this obviously from before because I'd worked in Colombia, but the level of political analysis in Colombia, wherever you are, in the smallest village, you know, in the most sort of isolated environment, is incredibly sophisticated. I've always been very impressed. And it's really in my interviews and conversations that people were mentioning this sort of toning down of the rhetoric and the narrative on the part of the government. Like, analysts were picking up on it, of course, because they were living it and experiencing it, right? And then it's when I went back and looked at the text. So when I did this discourse analysis, right, but I tried to do it in a very sort of contextualized and historical framing. So I did it over 20 years. So it was a lot of statements I had to go through, but really to trace the way both the government and the FARC had typified each other over that period of the conflict, how it shifted and how easily or with difficulty did it shift, that I could really notice the pattern, right? What you're describing and the number of times that the word terrorist was used and how it suddenly disappeared and who was still using it and who wasn't, you know? And so I think one thing I would like to acknowledge is, I think often in research, we don't acknowledge enough the analysis that comes out of our participants, I guess, you know, the people that we interview. And so in the book, I try to highlight this, you know, and be transparent about how our ideas emerge as well. So, you know, from conversations and then coming back to the empirics and then going back to the theory and realizing that, you know, there isn't such a thing. So then how do you describe it, you know? And I found that really exciting, actually, you know, during the whole process of researching and writing the book.
I'm so glad that that was an exciting process for you. It's wonderful when research is both intellectually interesting and also like, oh, I'm figuring this out. Oh, that was a really interesting conversation that's now made me think about this. So that's really good to hear. And I do always ask this question because it is so interesting and so useful, I think, to hear about that sort of behind the scenes making of the sausage part of academic research. And so as my final question, perhaps a cheeky one, because the book obviously is quite new and you have worked on it a lot, but it is done now. So what are you working on now?
Come on, Miranda. No, I'm joking. I just started going back this month to fieldwork and interviews. So I, because, you know, with COVID, it's kind of been quite hard. But so one of the key, another, I guess, thing that came out for me through the book that slightly shifted the way I was seeing things was that I feel that when we often talk about terrorism, you know, we completely focus on the non-state actor. And one of the big lessons of the book is that actually prescription affects the state as much as the non-state actor, you know, and you have to look at both of these actors in your analysis. And so I'm interested and intrigued by the idea that we should use the tools that we normally use, say, to understand non-state actors, you know, and the tools that we normally use to understand state actors. And, you know, are they or not that different? And you know, I come from the field of international relations, where we obviously, you know, tend to focus quite a lot on the state. So I'm trying to flip that around a bit, and my sort of ongoing and future research, which I'm just starting off now on, is to use tools that we've used to understand the diplomacy of states and the foreign policy of states, but on non-state actors. So I'm trying to, again, coming at it from the empirical side and looking at a range of cases, and to try and see how they do international relations and how similar or not is it with the state, and do the concepts we know of diplomacy and foreign policy, do they actually fit, you know, non-state actors as well, or is there something else going on? And obviously, I'm particularly interested in this transition still from, you know, kind of violence to other strategies, to non-violence. I'm trying to understand what role international relations plays in that transition, if you like.
Okay, well, you've got at least one reader, because that sounds fascinating.
Okay, great. So I need to write that next book.
Great, please go write that next book. And while you are off doing that, listeners can look at the book that we've been mainly talking about, which, as a reminder, is titled Prescribing Peace: How Listing Armed Groups as Terrorists Hurts Negotiations, published by Manchester University Press in 2021, and again, just won a BISA award for Outstanding First Book. Thank you so much, Dr. Sophie Haspala, for being on the podcast and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thanks so much, Miranda. I really enjoyed our conversation.